May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Salovey, representing the appellant, Stephen Bartholomew. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case, this appeal, involves putting life and blood into the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. This trial was really nothing more than a ghost of a trial. It was a trial by hearsay witness. It was a trial in which the state's star witness never appeared. It's a trial where the state used the media to locate the hearsay witnesses, but did much less to locate Colleen Anias, the alleged victim in this case. Colleen Anias never appeared, but what was remarkable about this case is she did appear prior to the verdicts being issued. She appeared 2 blocks away from the courthouse, being cited by the police for public drinking, within the police grasp, just 2 blocks away from the courthouse. Had the police had an all-points bulletin out, as they had originally, she would have been found, and Mr. Bartholomew would have had his Sixth Amendment right to confrontation. Not only that...
Counsel, could I ask you a clarifying question, please? So am I right in my thinking that on the Sixth Amendment issue, it turns on whether what the Ensleys, what was said to the Ensleys is testimonial? Because if it's not testimonial, then it doesn't have to be shown that she's unavailable. But if it is testimonial, then that is required. So maybe I'm missing something, but it seemed to me that if the statements that she made to them as she came out of the woods were non-testimonial, then it doesn't really matter if she's not unavailable.
Your Honor, there's 2 ways that habeas relief could be granted. One is the Sixth Amendment, and one is the Due Process Clause of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment. And the state has a duty of good faith and diligence to bring its witnesses. The burden is on the state. Also, even if the statement is not testimonial, it could come in under a due process analysis, as the United States Supreme Court stated in Bryant and in Davis. In other words, that if all the statements were not excited utterances, then those statements should have been not presented to the jury, if not all those statements. And remember, it was a 20 to 25 minute ride in a truck, in a warm truck, while Colleen Anias, the alleged victim, was wearing a floor length parka. Surely not all of those statements could have been excited utterances. And the United States Supreme Court in Davis expressly instructed, as well as in Bryant, that lower courts, must parse out what are testimonial statements, non-testimonial statements, what could be excited utterances, what would fall in. In other words, the charge from the United States Supreme Court is to look at everything. Just don't look at the one frame of time, the first thing that was said in the beginning.
Since we're here on habeas review and we're looking at clearly established Supreme Court law, how do we square this question with what was specifically reserved in Bryant? And that's whether statements made to non-law enforcement individuals are actually testimonial in these circumstances. And then even Justice Scalia, who, of course, was in dissent, having been the Crawford author, he even said he was agnostic on that point. So one question I have more pointedly is, how do you jump this AEDPA hurdle in light of the new recent Supreme Court case?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I never thought I'd hear Justice Scalia use the word agnosticism. But he did. But what is important, I believe, is that the Washington Court of Appeals, when they reviewed this case, they did not carve out this exception. The Court of Appeals did not rely on to Aline and Alice and the Ensleys being private citizens. They did not make that analysis. And this court has instructed in Franz v. Hazy, which is 533 F3rd 724, 2008, it's an en banc decision. The en banc Ninth Circuit Court says that the reviewing court must look at just what the reasoning of the lower court was. They have to look at the reasoning. They say we confine our analysis to 2254 D1 analysis to the state's actual decisions and analysis.
And so what was it that then would be contrary to Supreme Court law?
There was a very broad charge in Crawford. Crawford basically gave the charge to the lower courts. And there is a specific core class that we're asserting that the statements fall under. The core class is statements made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available at a later trial. That's broad. I do not believe that the United States Supreme Court was stating to the lower courts, let's look for another spotted calf case. Let's look for another case that has the exact same fact pattern. And by the way, we will shelve Crawford. We will shelve Davis. We will shelve all these cases until you can provide us a case that's exactly similar. And also, I think it's important to consider what is at stake. Crawford was a paradigmatic case. It overturned Roberts, a rare thing for the United States Supreme Court to do. It concerned a core constitutional right, a fundamental constitutional right, which this case really illustrates how important it is, because we had a trial by hearsay witness. We had all sorts of things decided. I bet every juror who heard that evidence in the case was asking themselves, where was Colleen Anais? I sure would have loved to have heard her testimony. It would have been really important. This was not a true trial in which the framers of our Constitution envisioned.
Can I go back to Judge Gould's opening question, though? You segued, understandably, into Bryant, but are you trying to bring yourself, nonetheless, under the Crawford-Bryant analysis, or are you pitching your case now more as a due process issue, which is what the substance or the thrust of your most immediate statement seems to be saying? Which is it?
I believe we have alternative forms of relief. We're not. Both provisions are available. If it's both,
I can understand that. So what is the clearly established Supreme Court authority that the Washington Court of Appeals violated on the due process side of the equation?
Well, on the due process, there's the United States Supreme Court has a series of precedents that describes what an excited utterance is and what an excited utterance is not. Also, the clear Supreme Court case law in Bryant and in Davis provide that it's important to parse out. As a matter of fact, in the footnote, they say, let's look at it. You know, trial courts will instinctively know, and they'll redact statements. So they'll look at motions and liminees and redact the statements. That's what trial courts do. That is their job. I'll reserve.
Reserve the remaining?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Sampson?
May it please the court, John Sampson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the respondent. As this court is aware, the Supreme Court last week issued the Davis case, and in footnote 3, the court recognized that Davis explicitly reserved the question of whether and when statements made to someone other than...
I think you actually mean Michigan v. Bryant.
I'm sorry, you're correct. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Michigan v. Bryant. I'm speaking too quickly. So the court last week recognized that it had explicitly reserved the question in Davis as to whether statements to a private person could be testimonial. And the court in Michigan v. Bryant recognized that it was not deciding that issue in this case. There is no Supreme Court holding that says statements to a private person are testimonial, and therefore the law is not clearly established on that point.
Mr. Sampson, then, There's no law clearly focusing on that point. But if the Supreme Court's law is read to establish a general test that you say, well, would a reasonable person think this is likely to be introduced at trial? If that's the case, then what's the analysis as to whether the application of that here by the state is objectively unreasonable?
If the test is a broad general principle, then the Supreme Court in the Yarbrough decision recognized that when it's broad, then the states are given even more leeway in applying federal law to the facts of their case. And when you're dealing with a broad principle, it's even harder for a petitioner to show a state court decision is objectively unreasonable. And the court in this case applied a broad principle, applied the Crawford standard, and determined whether or not the statements were testimonial. And the court looked at factors such as the Inslees were driving down a rural part of Washington. They saw someone on the side of the road who appeared to be in need of assistance. They pulled over. The Mrs. Inslee basically yelled at her husband that we have to go back, somebody needs help. So they were acting not in the role of law enforcement seeking to solve a crime, but were acting as good Samaritans seeking to help somebody in need. The court also looked at the fact that the first statements by the victim, Anais, were said almost spontaneous to a question of, are you all right? She almost spontaneously responded that she had been beaten up by her daughter and her daughter's boyfriend and left in the woods. Those were statements made as they were walking to get into the truck. So the court looked at the various factors, applied in an objective test, which is the proper test under Crawford and under Michigan versus Bryant. So the court's decision cannot be shown, even if the court, this court were to believe the state court was erroneous, it's not objectively unreasonable.
Okay, then how do you address the due process issue raised by the appellant, which is, I guess, still has to face an AEDPA hurdle?
Yes, Your Honor.
But what's your analysis on the due process issue?
Well, the due process issue, the court in the Michigan v. Bryant case did reference, and I think petitioner is talking about footnote 13, where they talked about, in addition to the Confrontation Clause, there will be rules of evidence, there will be due process requirements that must be met. I'm not aware of any holding of the Supreme Court that says unavailability is an issue of due process. I have always viewed it as an issue under the Confrontation Clause. And if the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply, in other words, it's not a prior judicial statement or it's not testimonial, then unavailability is not an issue. I'm not aware of a Supreme Court holding that says unavailability is a due process requirement. It is a requirement of the hearsay rules under ER 804, but it's not been clearly established. But even if it were, the state court here did address that claim, and the state court determined that the prosecutor did exercise reasonable diligence in trying to obtain Ms. Anais' presence. They served a subpoena on her. They sent notice of the date of trial to her post office box, and the state court found, both the trial court and the court of appeals found that there were reasonable attempts made to obtain her presence. Even if the due process claim is based on a holding of the Supreme Court, again, it's not objectively unreasonable for the court to reject that claim.
But see, you said that the unavailability is tied in with the hearsay rule, but as I understand the argument, the hearsay exception only comes into play if the witness is unavailable. And the due process argument here is the hearsay exception that was invoked was excited utterances. So that's the due process issue, and so I don't understand why unavailability somehow that falls out as a due process analysis?
Your Honor, unavailability is an evidentiary requirement only under 804. Excited utterance is a hearsay exception under 803, and 803 does not require a showing of unavailability. Moreover, even if there's a violation of a state law, a state evidentiary rule, that is not enough to show a constitutional claim entitling a person to relief in federal habeas. They would have to show that if it was based on a holding of the Supreme Court, that it rendered the trial fundamentally unfair. And I would submit that that's simply not a situation here where the Supreme Court has not recognized that unavailability is a requirement except in a narrow line of cases. I believe White versus Illinois addressed that. Idaho versus White addressed that. But this court has also said in the Crawford case and the Davis case that unavailability really is tied into testimonial statements. If it's non-testimonial, the Confrontation Clause doesn't apply, so therefore the court really doesn't even consider unavailability at that point.
So you're basically saying that if you determine that these are non-testimonial because they're not made to a police officer, that there's no federal review of conclusory or conclusion hearsay statements that would be made in a state court trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Those are all then...
They're all off the table. There's, you know, if it was made a week before and it was pure hearsay, there would be no constitutional hook to bring that to federal court?
If it's non-testimonial, that's correct, Your Honor, because those are all evidentiary rule violations, and that's all a matter of state law. And I think the Supreme Court in recent cases has informed the lower courts that habeas cannot be based on violations of state evidentiary rules. It has to be a holding of the Supreme Court. And I am unaware of any holding of the Supreme Court that says unavailability is an issue except under the Confrontation Clause.
So if the court, if it were clearly established, or if it were established enough, notwithstanding Bryant, I realize that's probably an untenable position given what they've said about reserving the question, but if a statement to a private party could be, under the Crawford-Bryant analysis, subjected to an objective assessment from the perspective of both the witness and of the proposed private party is going to testify, so that we're undergoing a testimonial analysis. Even, in other words, it's not limited to just statements to cops. Then the unavailability aspect would be part of it.
If the statements were
testimonial,
yeah, then it would be a part of it. And in this case, the state court said that she was, they determined that she in fact was unavailable, that the prosecutor exercised reasonable diligence in trying to obtain her presence and they were unable to do so. And so even if that were all clearly established and it was a testimonial statement, the unavailability fails because petitioner does not show the state court's decision was objectively unreasonable on that issue. Okay. The state would ask that this court affirm the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, there is United States Supreme Court precedent that hooks in the Due Process Clause to this analysis. Barber v. Page is a United States Supreme Court opinion. Justice Harlan, in his concurring opinion, provided that the failure to attempt to secure witnesses' presence denied due process. In Chambers versus Mississippi, the United States Supreme Court provided that confrontation rights, quote unquote, have long been recognized as essential to due process. And in Windsor v. Hall, the Ninth Circuit provided confrontation clause recognized as component of the 14th Amendment due process clause. Also, there's a concept in due process of basic fairness. And Judge Gould, in the opinion United States v. Yeda, Judge Gould authored that opinion. In that case, the government deported a witness after first obtaining a statement, and it was found to be unfair. And this, the United States Supreme Court has provided that due process and confrontation are inextricably bound together. They cannot be separated out. And also in terms of testimonial, non-testimonial, respondent provides that statements were made immediately by Colleen Anais upon being found by the Ensleys. And I asked the court to look at the record carefully, because the record actually did not very clearly establish that. There was a question, and then counsel stopped the answer, and it was all very confused. If you look at Mr. Ensley's testimony versus Mrs. Ensley's testimony, he only talks about what happened in the truck. It's all very confused about what occurred. And that's why parsing out this idea of evolution that the United States Supreme Court provided in Bryant and in Davis, that statements evolve, that it is the duty of trial courts, basically duty of trial courts, to parse out what's okay and what's not okay, what's testimonial, what's not testimonial, what's an excited utterance and not an excited utterance. And it's important to note that Colleen Anais, she came with the equivalent of a testimonial smoking gun. She brought out these jumper cables. She alleged that this happened 2 to 3 hours before. Most people, if they were tied up in the woods face down, would immediately throw off your bounds.
Just all of you have gone way over your time.
I apologize.
So you might, no, that's fine. You just might want to bring it to a close. That's
okay. So, Your Honor, I believe this comes down to basic fairness. Basic fairness that's bound up with the Confrontation Clause and what's essentially a procedural error in terms of the structure of the trial. This is very close to a structural error because the trial was nothing like what the framers of our Constitution envisioned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I thank both counsel for your argument this morning. Bartholomew versus Boning is submitted.